Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. What are the potential side effects of cracker plants planned in West Virginia and Pennsylvania?
I stood before with the United Nations with my bag of polluted air.
Some folks in eastern Kentucky are having a potentially explosive problem with their wells.
And they was green flies all over the top of that well.
Some hot doings on a cold day recently at West Virginia University.
And we thought it would be a great idea to make a furnace where we could get a lot of metal out.
And new inductees joined the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame.
Opera was basically part of popular culture. And if you won the Met auditions, it was like winning, American Idol.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. This past week, a Brazilian company announced it might locate an ethane cracker plant and three polyethylene plants near Parkersburg, West Virginia. And Shell has talked about building a cracker plant in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looked into the potential impact these plants could have on their communities. In the last of four reports, he visits Norco, Louisiana, and a key figure in a fight against Shell.
Margie Richard is walking on a street with no houses anymore, just lawns.
But that's the backyard of my mom and dad house, which was right there, my mobile home, which was over here.
This is Norco, Louisiana. We're about 300 yards from the Mississippi River, 20 miles or so upriver from New Orleans. Richard is a 71-year-old former school teacher. She points to a tree where her mom used to sit.
She liked to sit outside, but it got to a point she couldn't sit outside because the fumes was always gas. She had to go inside.
The fumes she's talking about were coming from a petrochemical plant owned by Shell a few feet away. Shell built a refinery here in 1916. The New Orleans Refining Company, or Norco, ran the facility, and eventually the town adopted the name as its own. In the 1950s, Shell built a chemical plant near the refinery in an all-black part of Norco called Diamond. Richard grew up next to the plant, but years later, she would lead a fight to have the company relocate the neighborhood that she grew up in. As a child, she grew up smelling foul odors from the plant that she likened to bleach. She also remembers people in the town suffered from health problems, which she blamed on those fumes.
Everybody within these two streets had breathing machines in their house.
Then one day in 1973, a teenager named Leroy Jones started a lawnmower a few feet from a leaking pipeline, sparking an explosion. It killed an elderly woman who lived nearby. Her name was Helen Washington. Richard remembers the scene vividly.
And there on the ground was Miss Helen, who lived in the house under sheet. And I could smell her hair. It was just awful.
This was a turning point both for the town and for Richard. She began taking stock of the health problems experienced by people in her neighborhood. Her sister contracted a rare inflammatory disease called sarcoidosis. But the symptoms were so common, her sister didn't realize she had the disease until it was too late.
It's like an allergy. You think you got sinus or whatever. Certain times of the year, seasonal change.
Though there's disagreement over what causes the rare disease her sister had, some scientists think chemical exposures can trigger it. Richard suspects that was the case for her sister, Naomi, who died at the age of 43. Then in 1988, another explosion happened. This time it was at Shell's oil refinery in Norco. The blast killed seven workers and damaged walls and buildings around the town. It was so strong it set off alarms in New Orleans, 25 miles away. Richard decided to fight Shell to get the company to relocate residents away from both plants. Richard helped bring in an environmental group that monitored air emissions with 5-gallon buckets.
We learned how to capture the air, how to have statistical reports.
The group detected chemicals in the air that Shell had never reported to the state's environmental agency. This caught the attention of the press and regulators. Before long, Richard was being asked to share her findings. She spoke before the UN in the Netherlands, where she confronted a high-ranking Shell executive. She remembers the meeting in which he brought a sample of air taken from Norco.
I stood before at the United Nations with my bag of polluted air.
And she asked the executive, would he like to breathe the air? The gambit worked. A few weeks later, another executive from Shell knocked on the door of her trailer in Norco, wanting to talk. Soon, the company was offering to buy people's houses near the chemical plant with a minimum offer of $80,000. More than 300 families took the buyout, including Richard's. Throughout the campaign, Shell denied that its plant made people in Norco sick. And though it's the subject of much debate, there's no scientific proof that Louisiana's chemical industry has anything to do with the state's high incidence of cancer. According to the CDC, Louisiana has the second highest cancer rate in the country. A Shell spokeswoman says the decision to buy out homes was in no way related to health concerns, but part of a longer-term effort to create a green belt around the chemical plant. Still, even industry backers say big chemical plants in Louisiana are better neighbors these days than they were a generation ago when Richard was fighting Shell.
The industry recognized that it had to do a better job communicating with and listening to the citizens who lived in the communities around them.
Tim Johnson is a public affairs consultant to the petrochemical industry in Louisiana. He says experiences like those at Norco have been part of an evolution the industry has undergone in the past 25 years. Part of this had to do with companies simply wanting to do the right thing. But he even admits part of it was because they were forced to.
You have to be honest to say that a lot of the improvements they've made have been as a result of regulations.
These improvements have cut toxic air releases in Louisiana by about half of what they were in the early 1990s. The EPA now has a program to ensure that black and other minority neighborhoods like the Diamond Section in Norco aren't subjected to inordinate amounts of industrial pollution. Today, Diamond, the neighborhood where Margie Richard grew up, is quiet, except for the hum of Shell's chemical plant. About 40 families stayed here. Instead of being relocated, they received a home improvement grant from Shell. One man who stayed behind is Lionel Brown. On a Saturday afternoon, Brown tinkers with his brother's pickup truck in his driveway.
I saw no reason to move. Yeah. So I didn't want to sell. And then first of all, they wasn't giving enough money for what I had.
What he had was a house and four adjacent lots. Now that air monitors have been installed in the neighborhood, he's also not so worried about pollution. Brown works at a nearby chemical plant for Dow. That makes him feel safer about living next to the Shell plant, even though he knows the chemicals made at his job are dangerous.
They make stuff that'll kill you. Hey, you know? But everything is contained.
Margie Richard now lives 15 minutes away from Norco. She thinks community leaders in Pennsylvania need to pay attention to what Shell is considering for Beaver County.
You should have input in what is going on.
She says it took decades, but Richard thinks the town and the company finally learned this lesson. In Norco, Louisiana, I'm Reed Frazier for the Allegheny Front.
This series was paid for in part by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Meanwhile, an Italian-based automotive parts manufacturer announced plans to more than double the workforce of its location in West Virginia. Ashton Mara reports.
And today, thanks to our collaborative efforts and hard work, 250 West Virginians can look forward to good-paying new jobs.
Governor Tomlin made the announcement at Sojeffy USA's manufacturing plant in Wayne County. A $20 million investment by the Italian company will more than double the plant's workforce from 160, adding 250 new positions over the next 5 years.
There are 250 people who will be able to put food on the table. 250 people who will take pride in working for a world-class company like Sojeffy. And there are 250 West Virginians who will get good-paying jobs right here at home.
250 people like Frank Workman, a maintenance technician who started at the Pritchard location when they opened in 2004. Workman says the added jobs will be good for a county whose unemployment rate sits at more than 6%.
I think this community needs it. There's a lot of people looking for jobs, and it's a great opportunity for the community, the state, and all of the people that's involved.
The manufacturing plant produces automotive parts, including gasoline, diesel, and oil filters, and cooling modules. Beginning next year, the plant will start producing engine air intake manifolds, creating the need for additional technology and workers. So Jeffy currently employs a variety of personnel at their Wayne County location, from the assembly line to warehouses, from accountants to industrial engineers. General Manager Troy Thomas says positions will be added in all departments to handle the increased production.
Think about this for a moment. Over 25 vehicle models that you pass every day on the road are supplied from this plant, and that's soon going to grow. So it's impossible to miss the product that we produce in this plant.
The expansion announcement comes after a 13-day investment trip the governor and members of the State Department of Commerce took to Europe in October. There, they met and encouraged businesses to locate or expand their locations in the state, including a meeting with Sojefi's CEO in Paris. Thomas said the international company had planned expansions in North America before meeting with the governor, but his involvement encouraged Sojefi to expand in Wayne County.
Sojefi's plan for expansion in North America didn't have to necessarily be located here in Pritchard. There were other states that competed hard for that investment and those jobs. But, you know, obviously, we've had a good experience here, and the governor helped to seal the deal to make sure that Sojefi's expansion, for this product line at least, is going to be located here in Pritchard.
Tomlin says this type of announcement speaks volumes about the workforce and reliability of the business climate in the state.
Anytime a company is making that kind of an announcement, that kind of an investment, it shows that they have some faith in West Virginia.
Sojefi will begin adding positions in January of next year to start producing its newest line of parts for General Motors. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Pritchard.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Residents of Premium in Letcher County, Kentucky, made headlines earlier this year when they sued the nearby Sapphire Coal Company for ruining their water supply. But now some Premium residents have found a new and potentially explosive problem to deal with in their old water wells. WMMT's Parker Hobson has their story.
He lives here. That's the old home place. And then I live up there, and then Barbara lives over here.
Donald Adams lives on the land where he grew up, in a hollow called Johnson's Fork, near the community of Premium in Letcher County, Kentucky. Donald has spent a lifetime on his property, but he had never seen anything like what he found in his well one night in early September.
As I came out here one evening, I walked right through here, and when I got right there at this gate, I heard a big loud sound, and I started following this sound, and I come right out here, and the closer I got, the louder it was. I mean, it was a big roar, and just bubbling up, a bubbling sound, and a lot of pressure. I mean, you could tell the pressure was on that. And I got right here at this fence. And I'll show you right here, right there's the well. And they was green flies all over the top of that well, was green flies. And I said, what on earth is that?
The green flies were attracted to methane, a colorless, odorless gas that also happens to be flammable and explosive. And it was gushing out of Donald's well.
And that fire marshal, they come that evening, and he said, I said, my porch light's on. He said, don't turn that porch light off. He said, just a light switch could ignite that. Get your family, leave, and leave now. I wish that you could have heard that right there. It was scary. It would. It would really scare you.
Donald's sister, Barbara Morgan, lives just down the road with her husband, Henry, and she soon found out they were living on top of methane, too.
After that, I had them start checking my well, and it registered as much, if not more, than his did.
The danger around methane is that it is a flammable gas with explosive potential if it is in large enough volumes.
Gordon Bowers is a geologist with the Kentucky Department for Natural Resources. He says it's not necessarily dangerous to have methane coming out of a well, but that it certainly poses a risk.
Methane is dangerous if it's found in contained spaces. Really, that's the biggest danger right there, is if methane gets into crawl spaces or basements, that kind of thing, where you can get it in an enclosed space and you get it in the proper ratio between 5 and 15%, and if there's an ignition source, then you can have an explosion.
Methane exists naturally in coal and can be found in high concentrations in underground mines. Methane explosions have caused some of the worst coal mine disasters in history, including the Scotia explosions, which killed 26 people at the Scotia mine here in Letcher County in 1976. State inspectors determined that the methane on Johnson's Fork was coming from an old mine just down the road, owned by the Sapphire Coal Company. Residents said Sapphire had closed and sealed this particular mine about 9 months earlier, and state inspectors found that methane from it was being forced up under the Adams and Morgan properties. Gordon couldn't comment on the specifics of this particular case, but he offered an explanation for how this possibly could have happened.
I mean, when a mine is closed and sealed and the pumps are turned off, the water level in the rock formations starts to return to normal, and that water begins pushing methane gas either up dip in the mine or out through fractures that are connected to the mine. And if a well intersects any of those fractures, gas could easily be transmitted to a well.
Sapphire Coal is owned ultimately by Medinvest, a European steel and mining conglomerate run by Rinat Akhmetov, a Ukrainian multi-billionaire. Despite state inspectors finding Sapphire responsible for the methane coming out on Johnson's Fork and issuing the company notices of non-compliance, Sapphire says there isn't proof that the methane did in fact come from their mine. A company spokesman told WMMT that even though Sapphire believes they're not responsible, they're still working to remediate the situation in an effort to be a good neighbor and to protect public health. But Henry Morgan said they never had problems with methane until the Sapphire mine was sealed. In his eyes, Sapphire is responsible, and they know it.
Well, when they come and start doing all the work that they've been doing around and trying to please you, you know, trying to make you go away, that's me at fault right there.
Henry, Barbara, and Donald all say that even though Sapphire has responded to the situation, the company has been difficult to communicate with and seems to be cutting corners. After the initial methane was found in Donald's and Barbara's wells, they say the company sealed the wells instead of constructing a vent to free the gas, something Barbara regrets.
They came and sealed my well off and sealed his well off and put cement in them, which in hindsight shouldn't have been done because methane needs a place to vent. And I questioned them whether I could deny them selling it or not. At the time, I didn't know if I could or not, but I know now I'm the landowner. I could have probably stopped them. 2 days after they sealed this well, we had circles in our yard, anywhere from 6 inches to maybe 14 inches, that started forming. That was back when the grass was still green. And every morning you would get up and there would be a new one of them. So I had read up about methane, and methane will kill grass when it's coming up through.
Gordon Bowers said he hadn't heard personally of methane leaving dead spots in a yard in exactly this way, but he said it was certainly possible because when methane is pressurized, it will look for the nearest places to vent, wherever that is.
Something that is a lot of people want to do is they want to plug that well. They want to get that methane gone. But unfortunately, when you plug a well, you're plugging the escape route for that gas. It's an easy escape route. It's You know, it's the easiest way for that gas to get to the surface. And if you plug that, it's going to find another way. And you don't know where that's going to be. It may start coming up in a crawl space or in a confined space somewhere else, and you won't know about it.
And if methane were actually to leak into Donald or Barbara's houses, it's not just explosion that they'd have to worry about.
One of the other dangers, and this is not something associated with methane, but this is associated with mine atmospheres, which is what is being produced along with the methane, is that more often than not, they're very low oxygen, sometimes no oxygen. It will all be methane and nitrogen with traces of carbon monoxide and things like that. And if that is to get into a basement or something like that, and someone was to walk down to the basement, they could just drop because there's no oxygen.
Being unable to afford hotel rooms or to find any place else to stay, Donald, Barbara, and Henry have been essentially living on top of this gas for 2 months now, with no idea where it could surface next.
We know to dodge that whale.
Right.
But we don't know where to dodge the staying in the house or not. You know, who knows if it's coming out near the floor or not. I'm actually afraid to have my grandkids here. And if these brown spots come out here in the grass, if it was coming up out here in the grass, it's common sense it was coming up near the floor here too, you know. So I don't feel safe having my grandkids even here.
In addition to the constant fear of either explosion or asphyxiation, living on top of methane has had other consequences as well.
We live here. We've put a lot of money into this place. We got it built up the way we want it and everything. And then here this comes along. And right now, if I wanted to sell out, I couldn't give it away. Would you buy this place and it would gas and under it? That's my biggest issue. They just actually reach out and pull the value of our home away from us.
Right around Halloween, methane was found in yet another spot on the property, in an old well right next to the road. This time, Barbara and Henry asked Sapphire to vent the methane properly instead of sealing the well. But they say the company cut corners here, too. The Federal Office of Surface Mining recommends that methane vents be made of a durable material like steel and be at least 10 feet high and placed preferably at the top of the nearest structure to keep the gas elevated and to keep the vent from being tampered with. The vent that Barbara and Henry say the company built is a thin PVC pipe about 7 feet high and spewing methane right next to the road, at a point where cars often stop or turn around. The coal company said everything it's done has been according to regulation. But throughout these 2 months, Donald, Barbara, and Henry feel like it's been hard to get straight answers from the company about what's happening or how much danger they're actually in.
Anyone that's higher up that needs to be coming here and talking to us, they dodge us like we're the plague. They just don't want to even talk to us. And I've suggested to them, someone higher up just come here and talk to us and see what we want. And they've not responded. They won't respond. And this one guy gave me his card, and it had a false number on it. Because I called it the next day, and the number I got a hold of, I don't know who I got a hold of. They wasn't sober, I'll put it like that. So one card actually had a false number on it. They think we'll go away. We're not going away.
There's an old well buried somewhere in Barbara and Henry's yard that they fear will be the newest place the methane pops up. And they've asked the coal company to find the well and vent it, a request they say the company has refused. So as they have been for 2 months now, Barbara, Henry, and Donald are left living on top of unknown amounts of pressurized methane, waiting for help from a coal company headquartered across the world that maintains it's not responsible.
Everybody's just playing for time, hoping it will dissipate and go away. How long will it take for it to go away, and where will it pop up in the meantime?
As far as I know right now, that gas could be coming up down at that chicken coop. It could be coming up over here. You don't know. And they can't give you an answer on when will it. They just say it'll go away eventually. Well, when do you think? I don't know. I can't answer you on that. So you're left in the dark. So you've got to worry for a long time Reckon it's gone or reckon it's still under me. I don't know what to do. I don't know.
Reporting for WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
More than 700 West Virginia coal miners are expected to lose their jobs by the end of this year. The state just wrapped up a series of rapid response meetings to help the miners survive. West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly attended one of the meetings and has this report.
You need us. And as many of these folks have stated, you guys have worked.
One by one, representatives from different support services like the Department of Health and Human Resources shared ways their groups can help laid-off miners.
We call it the SNAP program.
They're talking to a group of laid-off coal miners in a conference room at Summersville City Hall. The room is filled with mostly men wearing reflective striped jackets and caps with names like Massey Energy, Alpha Natural Resources, and Consol Energy. The former coal miners listen intently, often with wary expressions on their faces. One man brought his wife and child.
We give you 26 weeks, which is about 6 months.
Robert Lefevre is sitting in the back of the room. He recently lost his job driving a coal truck.
Oh, well, you know, one day at a time. That's all you can do.
The Clay County resident started work in the coal business in 1980.
They sent me papers to come up to get retrained. So I want to see what they got to offer.
The meeting was meant to help miners file for unemployment and let them know about available funding for new training through groups like the Division of Rehabilitation Services.
ADHD. You could have a hearing impairment, visual impairment. Emotional problems. Depression.
Many of the miners and their family members likely qualify for up to $5,000 in funds for classroom occupational skills training through the U.S. Department of Labor. The federal government awarded West Virginia a nearly $2 million emergency grant in late June of 2012. The funds are available for those dislocated from a West Virginia coal company after March 1st of last year. Workforce West Virginia is administering the grant and says more than 140 coal miners have completed training through the Coal Mining National Emergency Grant.
They're devastated because they lost a good paying job and one of the best paying jobs in West Virginia.
Brett Dillon is the director of the United Mine Workers of America Career Center in Beckley.
Their first hope is that they're going to get called back to their job or get another mining job. And the reality may be that it won't happen.
Dillon has been helping with rapid response meetings for more than 15 years.
The number of miners getting laid off in the 90s is compared to what is being laid off now.
Workforce is reporting that more than 4,200 West Virginia coal miners have lost their jobs since March of 2012. But those numbers don't tell the whole story. The nature of the industry is such that mines open and close frequently, causing layoffs, then job creations, and thus the boom and bust cycles. Workforce couldn't offer a state breakdown of mining job creations. But according to the U.S. Census Bureau, there were about 4,000 coal jobs created from April through December of 2012. Still, numbers for job creation in 2013 are not available. UMWA Career Center partners with several of the community colleges and universities throughout the region, including RCBI, or the Robert C. Byrd Institute. RCBI has created an individual program designed for coal miners. Laurie McCormick is a workforce recruiter at RCBI. She says the school has condensed a 2-year associate's degree into a 9-month training program in robotics technology.
This is training where they can have a job waiting for them. In this economy, the technical fields are where the higher pay is and where they can have a job when they get done with that schooling.
Brett Dillon is encouraging every miner to reach out for some form of retraining.
So I tell them that while they're drawing unemployment, don't sit on the couch watching TV. Go ahead and get some training. You know, maybe you'll get called back to the mines. Maybe you'll get another mining job. You may not need this training. You may not use it. But there's always a possibility that you'll get laid off again and you'll have that training on your resume, which may help you get a job then.
A study released late last month by the Colorado-based environmental organization Clean Energy Action predicts mineable coal could run out in as few as 20 years. It challenges the federal estimate of more than 200 years, arguing that the more easily accessible coal is already gone. Dylan says it doesn't seem like a typical bust cycle.
Market plays a big part, the coal prices. You know, you can't produce coal if it costs you more to produce it than it does to sell it. You know, you're not going to go in the hole because you can't survive like that.
In 1950, with close to 100,000 people living in McDowell County, coal was king. After that, mine mechanization led to widespread job losses, and people left to seek work elsewhere. The loss of coal jobs and lack of economic diversification brought hard times. The county now deals with high poverty, drug overdose death rates, teen pregnancy, and other symptoms of a depressed economy.
What I tell the guys when they say, you know, all I've ever done is coal mining, I can't do nothing else. Well, the first thing I say, that's bull. You know, you have been a coal miner for a number of years, and coal miners are very resourceful. You know, you could call a lot of them MacGyvers.
And this isn't the first time Lefevre says he's been laid off from a mining job.
Always went back to coal business, you know what I mean? Now they're all shutting down around where I live, so.
He says at the age of 51, he'll try another occupation.
It's not as good as coal business. It ain't. There's nothing out there as good as coal business. Everybody knows that.
Brett Dillon says the most popular retraining program so far is for a CDL license. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Summersville.
Meanwhile, Kentucky's Agriculture Commissioner James Comer is calling on leaders in the eastern part of the state to wake up about declining coal production. As WFPL's Philip Bailey reports, many interpret that as criticism of the region's longtime congressman.
Comer is considered a top Republican contender for governor in 2015, and his efforts to bring back the state's industrial hemp industry have earned him bipartisan praise. But GOP Congressman Hal Rogers, who represents the bulk of eastern Kentucky, stood against hemp legalization. Comer says the state needs to look beyond coal, but that leaders in that region are failing.
I'm from part of Appalachia. And I can say this with confidence, a lot of times we have leaders that I don't think really have the best interest of their constituents at heart. And we just need to look for new leaders, and the people need to step up to the plate and be independent in voting for change in that part of the state.
Comer wouldn't specify which leaders, but adds Eastern Kentucky needs a new vision to pull the region out of poverty and government dependency. Philip Bailey, WFPL News.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. To commemorate Veterans Day this past week, Traveling 219 recorded an interview recently with World War II veteran William Sherman Beard of Hillsborough, West Virginia. Beard was 19 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. By late 1942, Beard was at the agricultural school at West Virginia University when he enlisted in the Army Air Force. He was eventually sent overseas at the end of 1944, where he saw combat flying B-24s over Europe.
I was with the 459th Bomb Group in the 756 Squadron, which was based about, if you look on a map and see Fuji, we were south of Fuji in what they call the Fuji Flats, and there was a number of Air Force bases that was covered up with units of the Air Force. So that's where we wound up. That was in Italy, yeah, in the southern part of Italy. The old B-24s, I don't know whether people know what they are or not, what they were, but they were four-engine aircraft. The engines were 1,200 horsepower each. The old things, I think, had about 110-foot wingspan on them. The crew for a B-24 was 10 people. That was a pilot and co-pilot, a navigator, and a bombardier, and then a six-man crew. radio operators, gunners, that sort of thing. There were four turrets on it that had 250 caliber machine guns in each one of them. They weren't all that easy to fly. They were built, well, they were built really to destroy property and kill people, and without any thought of comfort for the crew. That was the least of the things that were in it. Fighters were not our problem, really, at that time. That, of course, this was the end of the war. Flak was, because the Germans pulled all the guns back with them. The targets were targeted with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of guns. A lot of times you'd see ahead of you, it would just be black over a target where they protecting that target. It would just be black, and then you'd see planes go inside of it, I mean, go out of sight in it, and then you'd go in it. 28 of us would airplanes would go at a time, but we would meet up with hundreds of airplanes in the air. I mean, there'd be a string as far as you could see in the distance, and sometimes the law was that if you think you're in too close, just cut it in half and move in a little closer. Sometimes it was wingtip that was over top of wingtip. And the guys that were in the back, they were sucked up until they could almost shake hands with the tail gunner in the next plane. And that's the way we flew. I think we were maybe not the best crew, we probably were the luckiest crew. And of course we got holes in our aircraft and chunks knocked off of it. And a couple of close calls for a couple of crew members. My navigator, Tony, up in the navigation department, there was a window, what they called it a bubble window, that was kind of a bubble that you could stick your head out so you could look down. And he just pulled his head out of that window when they blew it off and kind of blew a lot of plexiglass around on his, tore up his papers and stuff, but he didn't hurt him any.
Sherman Beard eventually settled back in Pocahontas County on his family farm, where he continues to live today. The story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, visit traveling219.com or Facebook. People, schools, and local businesses in Morgantown, West Virginia, pulled together to create a vessel with which to melt iron. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports that the inaugural iron pour was both very cool and very hot at the same time.
Anybody who wants to actually carve a little mold, we have some of these right here. So we're kind of setting up a station. And some of my graduate students and other students can kind of tell you how to do this. So we can actually get these prepped for you, and you can do it on site. It's going to be just like a cooking show. So you see your kind of like ingredients there. Art will get made here. So don't be shy and welcome. Let me know what you need.
West Virginia University Sculpture Area Coordinator Dylan Collins welcomed the crowd of about 50 people who showed up at the backside of the Creative Arts Center on WVU's campus to check out an iron furnace, pet named Sputnik. It was a cool day, actually pretty cold in the shade with the wind blowing, but Sputnik fired up pretty quickly and soon was melting iron.
This kind of started with myself and my friend Jeremy Entwistle, who is the sculpture program coordinator at Fairmont State University. We've been working collaboratively for the last year, going to cast iron conferences, getting our students together in order to work collaboratively casting in iron. And we thought it would be a great idea to make a furnace where we could get a lot of metal out. So he has a furnace at Fairmont State, but it does not have as much capacity as this, as Sputnik, our new furnace. So the idea was that we wanted to build a really great furnace that was not only had more capacity, but it also would be portable. So we could kind of, in theory, start to take this on the road and do kind of iron casting events in the region.
So they set to work. And now the beauty of getting sculptors to build, well, anything, is that they consider beauty while designing. And Sputnik is certainly a fun thing to look at.
It looks like a machine that has landed from another planet. So it is a giant furnace, a giant cylinder of metal that has another cylinder of metal like a donut around its midsection. And it's on three kind of tripod legs with little balls on the end. And then it also has on the top, it has a lid that swivels that has a stainless steel mohawk that is for venting fire, but also because it looks cool. So it kind of picture that it's kind of like Marvin the Martian, kind of that kind of a thing, almost like a Marvin the Martian metal casting furnace.
We've constructed in the last few weeks several sand molds to create negatives to pour in the molten iron.
Graduate sculpture student Megan Gaynor.
And we've invited a couple other universities. I believe there's people from Shepherdstown, Fairmont, and even Virginia Tech here. So, as well as a couple of other people from the community. So we're just trying to sort of involve the community in what we're doing and creating art, as well as creating sculptural items out of iron.
Local businesses, including Construction Supply Company, Three Rivers Iron and Metal, and Jack's Recycling, contributed to the WVU Iron Pour event by donating materials and supplies.
We'll start to heat it up with coke to kind of get it up to temperature. So coke is just coal that's been cooked in a kind of anaerobic environment. And then what we're doing next is once we start to get it up to temperature, then we're going to begin filling it with charges. Charges are buckets of pre-measured, broken up iron and more coke. So what happens is we continue to feed this thing and the well inside of the furnace starts to build up molten metal. We have a little bot, a little clay plug that kind of keeps the metal held back. But as this thing starts to kind of get built up, then we're going to tap out that clay bot and start to let this flow down a trough, so we can actually extract the metal out of the furnace. And then what we'll do is we'll take it, we'll put it inside of these different ladles, so it's a high temperature kind of basically cup. And then we'll have pour teams begin to get that hot metal into pre-made sand, resin-bonded sand molds.
Collins says the sand molds are the handiwork of students, faculty, alumni, and members of the public. The object of the day is not only to make art, but also to celebrate history.
We kind of like merge the past and the present. We're bringing together these two different eras and helping people engage with this really rich industrial history that's a real kind of mark of the culture here.
Collins hopes to be able to travel with Sputnik around the region, celebrating history and art. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Ford in Morgantown.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The West Virginia Music Hall of Fame inducts its latest class of notable musicians this weekend. West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees sat down to talk with Hall of Fame Executive Director Michael Lipton about some of those inductees.
That's Charleston native Wayne Moss performing the opening guitar riff on the Roy Orbison classic Pretty Woman. Moss is one of the artists being inducted. Michael Lipton, the executive director of the Music Hall of Fame, considers the induction ceremony and the short video bios about the inductees as historical documents that highlight the diverse array of musical styles the state is known for.
It really goes all across the board this year. It's everything from opera to gospel soul. And there's a number of things that are kind of particularly exciting about it. We have a number of video congratulations. Al Cooper, a very legendary producer musician, did one in his role is interesting. The Swan Silvertones, one of the footnotes in their career was that one of their songs inspired Paul Simon to write Bridge Over Troubled Waters. So Paul Simon is writing us a letter to read. Then we found out that Al Cooper was the one who turned Paul Simon onto the Swans because they grew up together. So Al Cooper's little video kind of tells that story, and it's really interesting. He said he brought these LPs over to Paul Simon's house and said, "Have you ever heard these guys?" And he said, "No." And I think it might have been even very late the same night or early in the morning. He gets a call, and Paul Simon says, "I think I wrote the best song I've ever written." And it was inspired by this Swan Silvertone song.
Which Silvertone song?
"Mary, Don't You Weep."
Oh, I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Martha don't have to mourn.
Oh, Martha, don't you mourn.
the sea one day. But Jesus said, Mary, your little sister don't have to moan no more. Now can I get a witness? He said, Mary.
Well, Tim O'Brien is no stranger to, I think, anyone into folk, bluegrass, Americana, and country in West Virginia. And his career has really, really taken off in the past few years. He won a Grammy, and his stock went up.
Walk the way the wind blows, cry the tears I cried, hoping for you, darling, to be here by my side. I gotta do some thinking of where to go from here.
Yeah, we have kind of three inductees that have deep ties to Wheeling. Eleanor Stieber was an opera singer from Wheeling. She may very well be the most internationally famous person we've inducted, which most people probably won't realize. I didn't realize it until I read her book, which is just unbelievable. It was at a time when opera was basically part of popular culture. And if you won the Met auditions, it was like winning, American Idol. You were an instant rock star.
How are you presenting Peter Marshall?
When love tells you it's over, goodbye. You'll be spending your time asking why. You're upset, but you can bet sunshine follows the rain. Well, my friend, that's the name of the game.
You know, most of us just thought of him as the Hollywood Squares guy, who, incidentally, he hosted 5,000 episodes. But he actually started as a singer when he was in his early teens. He was a big band singer. He went on the road. And he then went on to have a comedy duo with Tommy Noonan, who they appeared on Ed Sullivan and actually opened for Lenny Bruce at nightclubs, and I've been meaning to ask him about that. He did Broadway, West End in London. He's done it all, but his first and greatest love is big band music, and he's a veritable encyclopedia of, you know, you name a song and he'll tell you not only who the band leader was, but who was playing on the session, and he loves it, and he has some syndicated shows, Music of Your Life, where that's what he does. Presenting his award is Nick Clooney, who's a very, very old friend of Peter's from Cincinnati, and they've produced a couple of big band specials together.
Well, my friend, that is the name of the game. Oh, yes, my friend, that is the name of the game.
And this famous voice will also be honored.
I've got you under my skin.
Landau Eugene Murphy will be presented with the Spirit Award. Lipton says after winning the national TV reality competition show America's Got Talent, Murphy could have moved away from West Virginia, but chose to stay and use his notoriety to promote the state.
I've got you under my.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beth Voorhees in Charleston.
Not to give in. I've said to myself this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well that I've got you.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.